Everyone, to the Second Court of Appeals today. We have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket, and then we will take a brief recess for a panel change, and we have a case submitted on our 10:30 docket. But I think we're ready for the first case. If our clerk will please announce counsel and the time they've requested.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Berrigan. I represent the appellant Matt Henerlong in this case. It's a school discipline case. I was also the trial counsel and have represented Mr. Henerlong throughout the course of the litigation, which started in 2000. This is the second time I've come before the Fort Worth Court of Appeals asking it to declare something unconstitutional. The first time in this case was at the beginning of discovery when I asked the court to declare the Crime Stoppers statute, or part of the Crime Stoppers statute, unconstitutional because it violated the Texas Open Courts provision. Now that we've tried the case, I'm asking this court to address an issue which no Texas appellate court has yet addressed, which is the school district's so-called zero tolerance policy in school discipline. Is that compatible with due process? And we contend, of course, that it is not. You cannot have due process in school discipline if you have a zero tolerance policy such as that which the Arlington Independent School District had and has, and such as that which was applied to Mr. Henerlong in his senior year at Arlington Martin High School. Now,
is your challenge a facial challenge or an as-applied challenge?
As-applied. What happened in this case at trial, and the trial court did not make findings of fact and conclusions of law, but what it comes down to, if the only possible finding that the trial court could have made, and I realize the judge's letter to the parties after the trial, which announced her ruling, is not considered formal findings of fact and conclusions of law. But the only possibility here is that Judge Sutter found that this policy is rationally related to a legitimate state interest, which is the standard.
How do you respond to Appley's contention that the trial court could have found no damages and that, in fact, that finding is implied in support of the judgment?
Well, as addressed in the appellant's reply brief, the actual damages are not required to establish a violation of the Civil Rights Statute 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. I addressed that in the appellant's reply brief. Just as I hope, I shot down the other three possibilities that the appellee raised for affirming the trial court's judgment. That is, there was allegedly a failure to exhaust administrative remedies. In the first place, that's not even required in a 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 claim. You don't have to exhaust administrative remedies. However, Mr. Henerlong did. The second possibility was that he didn't show any actual damages. First, we contend he did show actual damages for mental anguish, which are recoverable under a 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 claim, but in any event, you don't have to show actual damages to prevail on a 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 claim. The third possibility they raise...
What would be the remedy then?
Nominal damages. I mean, we also sought injunctive relief and declaratory relief, and those are also recoverable in a 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 claim. So you don't have to show actual damages to prevail under.
So what you were seeking would be then just a declaration that, as applied to Mr. Henerlong, he was deprived of due process, and that's it?
No, we sought damages at trial, but because the court did not find liability, she found no violation, no constitutional violation.
I'm saying what would the damages be?
It would be his damages for mental anguish. That was pretty much it. It was too difficult to say, okay, I went to Vanderbilt instead of Princeton. What are my damages? It's almost impossible to prove that, you know, the fact that this incident probably resulted in Princeton not accepting him. He still got to go to Vanderbilt, which is a doggone good school. So, I mean, it was just too difficult to show any actual damages for that. But what he went through, and he testified about what he went through and how it affected him and ruined his senior year and hurt his self-esteem and all that, we felt like, you know, that was some evidence of mental anguish damages, but unfortunately we never got to that point because the trial court found no constitutional violation. Now, the third possible reason for affirming the trial court's judgment raised by the appellee is that Mr. Henrelong allegedly was never, there was no constitutional issue raised because he was merely, what they call merely assigned to an alternative education program, and thus no constitutional violations were implicated. Now, they rely exclusively on one case, the Stafford Municipal Independent School District case, for this alleged defense. I might point out the school district filed a motion for summary judgment on this basis, which Judge Studdard denied. But I realize since she didn't make formal findings of fact and conclusions of law, I have to address it. And I addressed it both in the appellant's brief and the reply brief. What happened, the discipline that was inflicted upon Mr. Henrelong goes way beyond being just assigned to a so-called alternative education program. In the Stafford case, the student who was disciplined stayed at his school. He was just sent to a different classroom where he had classroom instruction. It was an alternative education program, but he never left his school. Even the Stafford court, in a footnote at the end of its opinion, says this is not a case where the student was removed from his school and removed from the education process for a period of time. Well, that is the case with Mr. Henrelong. He was suspended immediately. He was sent to Turning Point High School, which is a different campus, a different school. He received no classroom instruction for 6 weeks. And if you look at the federal, the cases that we cite in our brief, it's very clear, including the Riggin versus Midland Independent School District case, which is cited in our brief, it's very clear that the discipline that was inflicted upon Matt Henrelong raised implications of due process, raised constitutional issues about whether he was being deprived of a protected property or liberty interest, as the case law calls it, in his education, because he was removed from the education setting. So I think it's pretty clear from both the appellant's brief and our reply brief that we have limited, it's very clear that we're limited to one issue here. Is the school district's zero tolerance program policy, rationally related to a legitimate state interest? Now, as I already mentioned, there is no Texas appellate court case on this issue directly addressing it. We see headlines in the paper every day about crazy discipline inflicted on students where a sixth grade girl gets kicked out of school because she has tweezers. In this case, we have a situation where a sophomore student who was the daughter of a teacher at the school went to her mother at lunch and said she had overheard that Matt Henrelong had enough alcohol in his car to entertain the boys and girls tennis teams at the upcoming regional tennis tournament. So they searched his car with his consent, and they found a thimble full of brown liquid in the bottom of an Ozarka water bottle that was buried under a bunch of junk in the back of Matt's Chevy Blazer. And for that, he got the same amount of punishment that he would have gotten if he would have had five cases of beer in the back of his car, which was basically what he was accused of. But all that was found was a thimble full of brown liquid in the bottom of an Ozarka water bottle. Mr. Henrelong, from the very beginning, said he had no knowledge of how that bottle got there. His coach believed him. What's amazing in this case is everybody believed him, except possibly the superintendent Burnt, and we'll get to his testimony in just a bit. But everybody believed that Matt was telling the truth, and they all said, our hands are tied. You were in possession of alcohol, and thus you get the same punishment that you would have gotten if you would have had five cases of beer in the back of your car.
Mr. Barron,
to the tennis term. Sure.
The briefs indicate that there was at least one chemical analysis made of the substance that was the thimble full of brown liquid
right in
the water bottle. Was there any evidence presented at the trial court in front of Judge Sutter as to the actual chemical makeup of the brown substance in the bottle?
Yes, there was a test done. It was introduced into evidence without our objection that showed it was ethanol.
Thank you, sir.
Which I think translates into alcohol.
I wasn't clear in whether that was just merely a matter that resulted from the criminal case filed, or if it became evidence in your civil trial.
Yeah, what actually happened in Matt's criminal case, he was given a citation for being a minor in possession of alcohol that day. When the trial in Arlington Municipal Court came up, the prosecutor didn't have the test results. But there had been a test done, which was ultimately introduced into evidence at the civil case trial without my objection, that showed that the substance was ethanol, which I think under the law translates.
What's your position as to the legal effect of a finding in the criminal case that it was dismissed and that he was not a minor in possession, mm-hmm. as far as that having any effect on being the law of the case, insofar as possession of alcohol is concerned?
That's an interesting aspect. I think I could not hang my hat on that, Judge, because I think from the very beginning, Matt and his parents conceded that the brown liquid in the bottle of the Ozarka water bottle was alcohol.
It passed the smell test.
Evidently, yes. Even though Matt didn't smell it, but they believed his coach and they believed the assistant principal who smelled it.
Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm. So, pardon me?
I said thank you.
Okay, sure.
I have a question.
Sure.
Is there any difference in the analysis applied under a Section 1983 due process claim versus a straight-up, you know, 14th Amendment due process claim?
I don't think so, because 1983 is just a tool to apply the 14th Amendment. It's just a statutory tool to get you into federal court or get you into the state court also.
Okay, then tell me why you think that the zero tolerance policy is not rationally related to a legitimate state interest when really it might not be the best policy, it might not be the most tightly related policy, it might be that there are better policies, but nonetheless I think all those under a constitutional substantive due process analysis are matters for the legislature. And all we can do is look and see, is there a rational relationship? And it seems pretty hard to say that there's not a rational relationship. It might not be the tightest fit or the most logical relationship, but it seems like there is a rational relationship. So tell me about that.
Okay. Well, admittedly, I hang my hat on a Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals decision called Seal versus Morgan that came out coincidentally right around the time we filed Matt's lawsuit. There is conflicting authority in Texas from the Galveston U.S. District Court in the Bay City Independent School District versus Bundick case, where that federal court basically just said, well, it's a zero tolerance policy, but we're supposed to defer to what school districts do, and so we're just going to defer and say it's not irrational. They didn't. The magistrate judge whose opinion was adopted by the federal district judge in Galveston in the Bundick case did not do the analysis that the Seal versus Morgan majority did. And so all I can tell you is I obviously agree with the majority in Seal versus Morgan, which is it's the court's job to determine whether due process has been given a student who's been disciplined. I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has said since at least 1975, yes, you are entitled to a modicum of due process in school discipline cases. And although we realize that courts are supposed to defer to the politicians in most areas, it's for judges, it's for courts to decide what is due process. And all I can tell you is our argument is if you're not even going to consider fault, if you're not even going to consider whether the student was consciously in possession of the contraband, that's not due process. Just to say you had alcohol, without delving into, well, how did it get there? How did this little bit of brown fluid in the bottom of his Ozarka water bottle get in the back of my truck? I've never seen it before. And everybody believed in me, yet they said it doesn't matter. The thimbleful was enough to give you the same punishment you would have gotten had you actually been caught doing what you were accused of. So all I can tell you is, yes, we hang our hat on Seal versus Morgan. I think it's a well-reasoned opinion, and it shows that the school districts have to consider fault. You can't just have a hearing where you say, we don't care what you say. We know what was there. We saw the brown fluid in the bottom of the bottle, and that's it. That's our only inquiry. And I know I'm almost out of time here, but If you look at Superintendent Burnt's testimony in this case, which I go into in detail on page 17 of the appellant's brief, he had a very odd procedure of his own. He's the last level of appeal, and he said, my policy was not even to look at the record before I have this hearing. I go in there cold and hear what they have to say. And he said the inquiry was over for him as soon as Matt and his parents conceded the brown fluid was probably alcohol. He said the inquiry was over for me there.
Sounds like to me that if we adopted your policy, it makes the prohibition against bringing knives or guns or liquor or drugs or whatever to school a farce. The school district will never be able to prove, if that's what you're wanting, prove taking into finding scienter that somebody brought it and put it in their trunk. They just have to say, I didn't know it was there. The keys lay around my house all the time. Anybody in my house could have put it there. I had no idea it was there. And that would happen in each and every, virtually every case. There'd be no policy.
Judge, all I can tell you is every one of these cases, if you look at the fact, like in the Bundick case, the student at Bay City Independent School District, he got caught with a machete in his toolbox in the back of his pickup truck after a drug-sniffing dog had alerted to his truck. They found a machete that he evidently had a part-time job at a sugarcane plantation or something because he had a machete. He admitted it was his machete. So that was not a case where all these cases are different on the facts. What I'm saying is if you're going to give somebody due process, yeah, possession is some evidence that you knew it was there, but it's not the be-all and end-all. In Texas criminal law, to be convicted of possession, it has to be conscious possession. The prosecution has to prove that you knew or should have known it was there under your control. And that's an inquiry that the courts make all the time. All I'm saying is to give a student due process, you can't just do what they have been doing and that has been so heavily criticized, which is abdicate responsibility for making some kind of truthful search for the truth in these hearings. They're meaningless without that.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning and happy Thanksgiving, and thanks to the court for accommodating my travel schedule by allowing us to go first this morning. Before I launch into my argument, there is one development that I feel like I need to bring to the court's attention, and that is that in preparing for this argument earlier this week, I learned that the school district's Code of Student Conduct has now been amended to expressly require the school district to consider the student's intent or lack thereof in the disciplinary proceeding. I also learned that this summer the legislature amended the Texas Education Code to effectively require school districts to consider the student's intent. And I wish I could stand here and tell you that I've had time to sort out what that all means. I have not. I think it at least potentially raises an issue as to whether the claim for declaratory relief could be mooted. But it does not appear to be a subject on which there's an easy answer. And I suppose what I would propose to the court is that the court allow the parties to submit post-argument briefs on this issue. That is assuming that we determine that it's something that we need to formally bring to the court's attention. And I apologize for just now bringing it to the court's attention.
That would be excellent. If you take a look at the materials and whether you feel like they're helpful or not, if you could advise us one way or the other, is 20 days an adequate amount of time?
20 days should be good. I won't be back in the office until Monday, but that'll give me 2 weeks. So I think that should be sufficient.
And a letter is sufficient. And in other words, you don't have to file another brief. If you can set the information, set it forth in a letter, that would be adequate.
And do you require a motion for leave with that?
No. We're requesting it right now. So you can just file it within 20 days and then you can have 10 days to respond. Is that
sure?
All right. Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And so I will now proceed with my argument. Of the various issues that we briefed, there are two independent reasons that I want to focus on today, two independent reasons why the trial court's judgment should be affirmed. The first is that Mr. Hennerlong was not expelled from Arlington Martin. He was instead assigned to an alternative education program, which was the Turning Point School. Under Texas law and under Fifth Circuit law, an assignment to an alternative education program is not a deprivation of access to education, which implicates any constitutionally protected right. And I heard Mr. Berrigan indicate that the only case we're relying on is the Stafford case out of the 14th Court of Appeals. There's also the Navarez case out of the Fifth Circuit and the Zamora case out of the 10th Circuit. That concept is very well established, that there must be a deprivation of access and that assignment to an alternative education program is not it. And there is a lot of evidence in the record, including the testimony of Dr. Byrne and the Code of Student Conduct itself, which say that an expulsion is a complete removal of a student from the educational system, and that assignment to an alternative education program is not an expulsion.
Taking direct issue with opposing counsel's statement that he did not receive education for a six-week period?
Yes, we are. It was an assignment to an alternative education program. His testimony was that he wasn't instructed in the classroom. There was testimony presented from the principal at Turning Point who said that they have a core curriculum of four subjects, that there are board-certified teachers in each classroom, and that there is instruction. It may not have – there was also testimony that there wasn't teaching of his advanced placement courses, but that efforts were made by the school district to allow him to continue with those classes and to keep up with those classes while he was at Turning Point.
Do you know whether students enrolled at Turning Point can actually graduate from that school, or do they have to be transferred back, or that's not in the record?
That is not in the record, and I do not know the answer to that question. The testimony from Dr. Byrne was that he was, as an accommodation to the Hennerlongs, he was transferred back to Arlington Martin before the end of the semester so that his transcript would not reflect any time at Arlington Martin, but I don't know the answer to that question.
So assuming that something about this went in his record, what other effect was proven?
Well, there was no effect proven. There was testimony that this was upsetting to him and his family, but there was no testimony that, for instance, that this prevented me from getting into the schools that I was applying to or anything else of that nature. And as he admitted, that they just didn't have that proof, and so that there is not that proof in the record. And, in fact, the evidence was that this incident was disclosed on his application to Vanderbilt, and even though it was disclosed, that he was admitted to Vanderbilt.
Okay, just as a point of curiosity, as I recall, Teacher Clements, let's say, enhanced what she had been told when she reported it. Didn't she say something about drugs? And in fact, she heard nothing about drugs. How in the world did she get out of this case? Like intentional infliction of emotional distress comes to mind.
My understanding is she got out on immunity and jurisdictional grounds. And I was not involved as counsel at the time that all happened, and it's not
employees versus the entity. Okay,
right. But she did get out, and I think there was a discrepancy between her recollection and her daughter's recollection about the issue of drugs. I think that's fair to say.
Perhaps, but go ahead.
So, the second point I do want to bring to the court's attention today is that the central premise of Mr. Hennerlong's due process claim is that the school district failed to consider or was prohibited from considering, based on its policy, his claim that he didn't knowingly possess this alcohol because it was somehow planted in his vehicle. and the record does not support that contention. Dr. Byrne, the superintendent, testified that he had the discretion to consider that claim, that he did, in fact, consider Mr. Henderlong's contention that the alcohol was planted in his vehicle, and that he rejected that contention because he found no evidence to support it. And Mr. Berrigan has said that their challenge here is an as-applied challenge to the policy. Well, as applied to Mr. Henderlong, there is no dispute that Dr. Byrne considered his contention that he didn't knowingly possess this alcohol and that he rejected that contention.
What evidence could he have presented to prove a negative?
Well, there were several options that were given to Mr. Henderlong by Dr. Byrne and were actually documented in a letter that he wrote after the hearing. He told the Henderlongs at the hearing that if you come forward with evidence like a polygraph test, some sort of independent witness who verifies your contention that the alcohol was planted in the vehicle, and in some of the other cases we've seen that the plaintiff is relying on here, there has been that kind of testimony. Oh, this knife that was in my glove compartment, you know, you bring in another student to testify, that was my knife. Johnny didn't know my knife was in the car, that sort of thing. Fair. And so he said that he would have considered that evidence, and they never responded to that offer. And under the circumstances, it was reasonable for him to conclude that there was nothing to that contention, and that's what he did. I also want to point.
I've got a problem with.
Yes.
I hope you can help me with, and that is, if you're going to set up a procedure for review of a initial finding by a person who made a search of a vehicle, and if that procedure is to have meaning, shouldn't there be proper inquiry in the procedure that would allow the overturning of the initial finding in order for the procedure to be meaningful? Do you understand me? If you have a zero tolerance, and if the fact is we found this water bottle with this brown piece of liquid in it, about a thimbleful, and it was alcohol, and if you start with that, and if all through the steps of the review process, you're bound by zero tolerance so that you cannot consider anything more than the fact that this water bottle was in the back of the vehicle, then isn't the review process itself meaningless?
Well, Dr. Byrne testified that he did consider that issue about whether the possession was knowing or not, and that he did consider it, and so it's not a case where there was no consideration given to that issue. There was consideration given, and he just found no evidence to support
what
that
issue
claim.
Did he consider?
He considered, his testimony was, he considered Mr. Henderlong's contention that the alcohol was planted in his vehicle, and he found no evidence to support that contention, and he also found that Mr. Henderlong knowingly possessed the alcohol.
Well, but my concern is that in zero tolerance, what you're saying is, how it got there makes no difference. It's just there. And once it's there, there's no explanation that gives any relief on any kind of review process, because the end result is you're out. That's it.
Well, the offer by Dr. Byrne was, if you can give me some sort of evidence other than just your say-so that you weren't aware of this alcohol in your car, then I will certainly consider that.
Well, so I heard you say that maybe in other cases there were circumstances might be where another student would come in and say, well, that's my knife.
Right.
Well, if that happens and zero tolerance is there, then that person is in the same problem as the initial individual is being charged.
Well, that may create a problem for the other student, but for this particular student, for Mr. Henderlong, the testimony from Dr. Byrne was, if he'd come forward with that evidence, I would have overturned the decision. And, you know, a lot of the evidence in this record is based on Dr. Byrne's testimony and also the Code of Student Conduct itself, But it is important that the Hinterlongs have conceded that the trial court, they concede this in their brief, that the trial court found Dr. Byrne to be a credible witness. And, you know, once that finding is made, that was solely the credibility of the witnesses is solely for the trial judge as the fact finder here to determine, and that's not something that can be challenged on appeal.
Does it matter at all that in the due process analysis that there's, what, five hurdles they have to go through before they can get to somebody who can actually consider whether or not it was a setup, whether or not that the alcohol was planted? In other words, it is, I think, as Justice Meyer said, through every level, no possession, and you have to, there's multiple hurdles before you finally can reach someone that.
I don't think so in an as-applied challenge, and when Dr. Byrne's testimony was that he conducted an independent review of the evidence. I mean, if conceivably you could be in a different situation with somebody who lost at the initial stage and got discouraged, but that did not happen here. Because it was taken up through
the
process.
That's a good point. I understand your point.
The bottom line is you have to prove your innocence instead of proving guilt here.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I think
it isn't unique. It's somewhat maybe revocation of probation.
Well,
you found the drugs. Now you've got to prove you're innocent.
Well, in criminal cases, we don't just if the accused comes in and says, "Well, I wasn't aware that these drugs or whatever it may be was in my vehicle." We don't just stand back and say, "Okay, well, you've got us there. We're going to have to let this person go because they've denied it." There is my vague recollection of criminal law is there's something of a presumption there that the possession is knowing if it's in your possession, and then the defendant can certainly come forward and give some sort of reasonable alternative explanation, which and there wasn't any evidence to support that explanation here. I do want to point out one final thing before I sit down, and this is something that seems to have escaped the attention of all the parties to this point. But in looking at the Code of Student Conduct, there is a separate definition of knowing of possession in the code itself, and that's on page 35 of Defendant's Exhibit 25. And it specifically defines possession with respect to possession of contraband in a vehicle as a driver or a passenger being in a vehicle and knowing that there is contraband in the vehicle. Again, that's something that has not come up before now, but that would also seem to undercut the claim here that this is a zero-tolerance policy that did not allow consideration of that issue as applied, at least as applied in this case, to this particular circumstance.
I have one last question.
Yes, sir.
If we're looking at a circumstance to where Mr. Hinterlong was an honors student participating in an honors program, and then he is transferred to the alternative school, that honors program didn't follow him to the alternative school, did it?
It did not, although there was testimony that the at Dr. Byrne's direction that the teachers at Arlington Martin and then also at Turning Point efforts were made to allow him to continue with those studies and at least keep up. But there wasn't in-class instruction on those
when you're looking
specialized
at constitutional
courses.
Deprivation of a educational privilege or right. Mm-hmm. The position of the school district is that his honors program didn't follow him. We might have given him a chance to do some of those honors things, but that wasn't significant enough of a deprivation of his educational opportunity that it rises to the level of a constitutional challenge.
That's correct. That to rise to that level, you would need a deprivation of
expulsion. Thank you, sir.
And that's not what this was. Thanks to the court.
Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, first, Superintendent Burnt's testimony is is not that long. It's in volume 3 of the reporter's record. And as I point out extensively in detail in the appellant's brief, everything he said on direct testimony and on my cross-examination was the inquiry for him was over as soon as Matt and his parents admitted at the level 4 hearing that the substance was probably alcohol that was found in Matt's vehicle. The inquiry was over for him then. The only testimony that he gave that could possibly be rationalized as being some testimony on his part that he actually considered Matt's fault is in response to two questions that Judge Sudderth posed to him after I had stopped my initial cross-examination, which is at the bottom of page 74 and the top of page 75 of volume 3 of the reporter's record. Now, those two questions that the judge asked him, the first one is incomprehensible. I mean, even though I was there and I didn't understand what she was asking him, and he said yes. And the question could just as equally have when you consider the question the judge asked him and his answer, it could have just as easily have been favorable to our side. And then the judge asked him a very leading question after that, so you considered whether he knew or not, and he said yes. Now, that contradicted everything that he had said up to that point, and it contradicts the letter he wrote for Matt to Princeton. He said in that letter to Princeton that, unfortunately, Matt was the victim of our zero-tolerance policy. And so I think the overwhelming weight and preponderance of the evidence that Superintendent Berndt gave at the trial is that the inquiry was over for him as soon as Matt admitted and his parents admitted at the hearing it was probably alcohol that was found in his vehicle. He applied the zero-tolerance policy. Now, once again on this issue about Turning Point High School, they keep calling it, it's just an educational alternate education program. It's just an alternate education program. It's not. It's an alternate education school. It's a different campus. The undisputed evidence at trial was Matt was placed on in-campus suspension at Arlington Martin for a few days, sent to Turning Point for what they call the Choices Program, which is just another suspension without any classroom instruction whatsoever. And then he was formally, after the Level 4 hearing, he formally enrolled at Turning Point, even though he had been there physically for weeks. He became a Turning Point student for a few weeks after the Level 4 hearing. But the undisputed evidence is he had no classroom instruction.
What does that mean? He's sitting in a classroom by himself looking at textbooks? What does that mean?
He got his advanced placement course books from Arlington Martin, and he did the work that he could do by himself.
Is there a teacher in the room?
No teachers. He received no classroom instruction at Turning Point.
All right. Are you aware of the new policy that we discussed a moment ago about possibly mooting this issue?
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I've already looked at the mootness issue briefly, and I'm not concerned with it. The law has changed. The legislature changed the law last summer.
And the school has changed their policy?
I didn't know that the school had already changed their policy. I was aware the legislature had passed a law.
Okay, how is what you're asking for different from what they've already done?
Well, there's a case from the Texas Supreme Court, as a matter of fact, that I've got.
Well, case law aside, I'm just asking you, what are you asking for?
We still have our damages claim. We still have our damages claim for an unconstitutional policy that was applied to Mr. Hennelong in 1999. I don't think the declaratory relief aspect of our claim is moot either. There's been no finding by the legislature that the zero tolerance policies were unconstitutional. They've just changed them. But Matt still has his damages claim. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you so much for appearing here today. We appreciate your arguments and your briefs. And happy Thanksgiving. You are dismissed.
Thank you.